from deep inside your radio.
So, ladies and gentlemen, this may be one of the last times that I can say at the end in that litany of crap that I recite at the end about where you can hear this broadcast, American Forces Radio. No, they're not aiming at me, necessarily. Dateline Washington from Stars and Stripes, the publication of the military. Military radio stations around the globe. Oh, sorry, I should do that, the Wolf Blitzer reading. Military radio stations around the globe soon could be playing more hip-hop, more pop hits, less country music, and no sports or talk shows. A media consulting group reviewing American Forces Radio. That's right, even American Forces Radio has consultants. It's a culture. It's an integral culture. Has recommended those changes as a way to boost ratings. The analysis of the radio broadcast is the first major review the over-air offerings of AFRS, whatever they call it these days, in over a decade. Warren Lee, Operations and Plans Officer for American Forces Radio and Television, said no decisions have been made so far, but officials are meeting to discuss the future, and the new review conducted by Lund Media Research will be the launching point. Lund surveyed 1,100 Armed Forces radio listeners this year and conducted 10 focus groups in Europe over the same time period. Hi, Europe. How are you? Nice to see you. The biggest change proposed would be centralizing most programming decisions in the United States and creating a pair of music stations for worldwide. First would feature hip-hop, rap, pop music, and other similar formats. A second station would have, hey, classic rock, alternative bands, and a mix of other top 40 songs. Popular talk radio programs such as Rush Limbaugh and those from national public radio as well as country music would be relegated, I think this is where I end up, on a third station, broadcast only in a few select areas. The recommendations also include dropping play-by-play of American sports events from over-the-air broadcasts, noting that only a small audience listens to the events. Fewer than 15% of the military said they'd listened to baseball, basketball, or hockey games on the radio in the preceding 6 months. Instead, those games will be offered only through your dentures. No, cable channels. The report also recommends removing the Tom Joyner Show. This is a very popular, in this country, African-American radio host, morning host, Tom Joyner, from over-the-air broadcasts, despite its popularity among minority troops. Several white respondents complained about the show, and Lund officials deemed it too controversial for Armed Forces Radio's attempt to broaden the listening audience. So you know where this program is going. Officials of the consulting firm found talk radio, both sports and politics, aren't a major draw for troops under 34 years old. Country music, while popular with some troops, is also despised by others, making it difficult to mesh with other musical formats. Implementation of the new plans will be pushed to January 2007 at the earliest. So don't worry, troops in Iraq, it won't affect you because you'll be gone by... None of the ideas are foregone conclusions, says the deputy director of AFRTS. The question, he says, is how do we grab the biggest share of the audience out there and still provide a service? The audience out there is troops, isn't it? Well, what else are they going to be listening to? They're in foreign countries. You expect them to learn the language? And, ladies and gentlemen, also at the top of today's broadcast, fears have surfaced that the days of palm trees could be numbered in the Torbay area, weakening the area's claim to be the English Riviera. This is in the United Kingdom. The palms were declared too hazardous to be used in some seaside areas. Landscape officers say the trees need to be treated with caution because their sharp leaves, we call them fronds here in this country, could scratch faces or even eyes, though nobody in the United Kingdom can actually remember any palm-related injuries. Tim Jones of the Devon and Cornwall Business Council said the move could damage the image of the community of Torbay, saying The nanny state has gone absolutely mad. The controversy blew up when plain and flowering pear trees rather than palms were planted in a shopping street redevelopment in Torquay, which is part of Torbay, don't you know? The town's Chamber of Commerce questioned the move and the very future of the palms, the species Cordyline australis. Paul Osborne, senior urban design and landscape officer, replied to the chamber, quote, "The palms need to be carefully and appropriately used. They can cause maintenance problems, and as they have very sharp leaves, need to be carefully used in the streetscapes where they could cause injury to eyes slash faces if inappropriately placed," unquote. Eyes could slash faces, I guess. Now he insists palms would still be planted in Torbay, but only in suitable places, such as seaside parks. The mayor of the community was unimpressed, saying, "I cannot see palm trees as a serious health and safety risk unless you're in the Caribbean and a great big coconut falls on your head." Do they have coconut palms in the Caribbean? I don't know. Ladies and gentlemen, keep it to yourself. Whatever you do, don't tell Santa Monica. Hello, welcome to the show.
The same thing again. Sometimes tears, oh, would fall like rain. But if I had to do it over, over again, I'd do the same thing again. Someone, hard times don't seem so bad. Oh, if I had to do it over, again, yeah. Oh Lord, I'd do the same thing again. Don't seem so bad. So if I have to do it over and over and over and over, I do the same thing again. Hey, I do the same thing, the same thing.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, bidding farewell to Billy Preston and welcoming you to this edition of the show. And
I fired, and there's Harry falling.
No, I'm fine. I am fine. I don't know what you thought happened, but everything's normal. Except, well, no, this is normal too. Dayline Washington, ladies and gentlemen, the Pentagon is still not determined the criteria the National Missile Defense System must meet before it can be declared operational. According to a new report, the declaration of operationality, if you will, isn't that the phrase all the people on TV news use to sound smart, if you will? The declaration has been pending since 2004 when the first ground-based interceptor missiles were deployed in Alaska following U.S. President George W. Bush as president. What did I miss? Decision in 2002 to deploy a system with limited operational ability. But in January of last year, shortly after an interceptor missile failed to lift off when cued to its target, Pentagon spokesman Larry DeRita, is that curly Larry DeRita? Said the system may never be declared operational. It would just continue to be developed and added on to. That sounds like the dream goal state for a Defense Department project. Just add on to it, and it never gets there. Man, can we all get jobs like that? No, there's no real deadline for what I'm doing, and it never really will actually be useful, but just keep sending money, and I'll do more of it. Quote, I don't think that the goal was ever that we would declare that it was operational. I think the goal was that there would be an operational capability by the end of 2004, Derrida said, in a quote that must be enshrined in the Washington Quotes Hall of Fame. The ground-based interceptors are meant to launch soon after a long-range enemy ballistic missile is fired at the United States. Like we have enemies that have those missiles now. Ladies and gentlemen. Racing out to space to smash into and destroy the warhead while it's still outside the atmosphere. Traditionally, this according to UPI, weapons programs proceed along a linear path from the identification of a requirement through research and development and then production. The final stage is preceded by a series of operational tests. If the system performs well, it is declared operationally suitable and effective by the Pentagon's independent testing agency. That was created by Congress 20 years ago to make sure the Pentagon only bought systems that worked as advertised. But the ground-based missile defense system is following a different track known as spiral development. Sounds like Hollywood, doesn't it? The system is built in stages, tested as it goes, and then added onto with no specific end state defined. It's the way we make movies. It works so well for us. The Government Accountability Office expressed concerns about this approach last week. Quote, without specific operational criteria, the Secretary of Defense will not be in a sound position to objectively assess competent commands and services preparations to conduct ballistic missile defense operations, nor have a transparent basis for declaring it operational, which will become more important as capabilities are added in subsequent blocks. I.e., what are you guys doing? What are you doing? I.e., so it's not operational, ladies and gentlemen. It's just like the flood control system in New Orleans. It's not operational, but we will add to it. And now, news of the warm.
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Dateline London. The world's deserts are under threat as never before, with global warming making lack of water an even bigger problem for the parched regions, according to a UN report this week. The first comprehensive look at deserts around the world said these areas, their wildlife, and most of all their scarce water supplies are facing dramatic changes. Deserts are the last great wildernesses and the Cinderellas of the conservation world, says Nick Nuttall, a spokesman for the United Nations Environment Program. Everybody cares about the mountains, he says. Everybody's worried about the oceans, but nobody really thought about the deserts before. They need help. Desert areas are almost one quarter of the Earth's surface, home to more than 500 million people, more than previously thought. Those are not probably the happiest people on Earth. Even now, most of the 12 desert regions whose future climate was studied face a drier future. According to the report, experts predict that rainfall will fall by as much as 20% by the end of the century due to climate change induced by, guess which species? That's right, dogs. I blame dogs for it. They're crapping too much. Compounding the threat is the melting of glaciers, a large fraction of water used for agricultural and domestic purposes in deserts in the southwest U.S., Central Asia, and South America come from rivers that originate in glaciers and snow-covered mountains. The glaciers on the Tibetan Plateau, though, may decline by as much as 80% by the end of the century, according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Quote, when the glaciers appear, you are in serious trouble, unquote, Andrew Warren, one of the report's authors and a professor of geography in London. The report warned that renewable water supplies fed to deserts by large rivers are also in danger because of climate change and booming growth. They're anti-growth. The report's authors urged more comprehensive water policies to manage the world's limited supplies. They warned that scarcity in water supplies in 2050 could hit Chad, Niger, Syria, and Iraq, if nothing is done. Congratulations, Iraq. We've given you democracy and taken your water. Get some from Niger along with the yellow cake. Water goes good with yellow cake, doesn't it? Warren also said urgent action was needed to protect wildlife in deserts, noting that increasing wealth in Arab lands has led to convoys of hunters sweeping through the arid landscapes of Arabia, Kazakhstan, and Sudan in search of prey, quote, shooting what they can or running it down in jeeps. We are westernizing the Arabs, whatever anybody thinks. When I hear that they're running down the livestock in jeeps, I know Western culture is spreading. Several species of gazelle, Barbary sheep, and a type of bird called the hubara, among the species considered under threat. All right. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. You can listen to it or not, as the case may be. Reasons to trust the CIA. 14 European states colluded with the CIA in secret U.S. flights, which terrorist suspects were taken to secret jails, where goodness knows what was done to them. This is the conclusion of a report by the European Union. Actually, Europe's human rights watchdog, the Council of Europe, says there's evidence to back suspicions that secret prisons are or were located in Poland and Romania, although both countries deny the allegations and denounce the alligators. Under the CIA policy of extraordinary rendition, prisoners are moved to third countries for interrogation. There have been allegations that some were tortured. Swiss Senator Dick Marty authored this report by the European Council. Following a seven-month inquiry, it began amid a political outcry over the media allegations about extraordinary rendition. Marty has drawn an air traffic log, satellite photos, and accounts of prisoners who say they were abducted. Spain, Turkey, Germany, and Cyprus provided staging posts for rendition operations. UK, Portugal, Ireland, and Greece were stop-off points. Italy, Sweden, Macedonia, and Bosnia allowed the abduction of residents from their soil. And Poland and Romania had these secret prisons. The Swiss senator says the U.S. must bear responsibility for the flights. He says the program could operate only with the intentional or grossly negligent collusion of the European partners. The spider's web of U.S. rendition flights, he says, is based on an utterly alien approach that breaches human rights. Polish Prime Minister describes the report as libelous, raising the question of, can you really libel Poland? More reasons to trust the CIA. The CIA suppressed the whereabouts of Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann to help protect high-ranking West German officials from possible revelations about their own Nazi backgrounds. This according to CIA documents released just this very week, only 50 years after it could have done anything to help. A March 1958 memo from West German intelligence informed the CIA that Eichmann, the senior Gestapo officer who oversaw Hitler's final solution to annihilate European Jewry, was living under the alias Clemens in Argentina, where he'd arrived 7 years earlier. Quote, it now appears that West Germany could have captured him in 1958 if it had wished to, says University of Virginia historian Timothy Naftali, director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library Museum. Quoting him, newly released CIA material suggested in the highest levels of the West German government there was concern about what Eichmann could say if caught about those close to the head of the government. The CIA could have also passed the information along to Israeli intelligence, which was conducting its own search for Eichmann in Argentina. The CIA organized Cold War spy networks that included former Nazis. It was not U.S. policy to track Nazi war criminals once the Cold War began, says Naftali. The CIA based its decisions about using former SS men or Nazis solely on operational considerations. Hiring these tainted individuals brought little other than operational problems and moral confusion to our government's intelligence community, he adds. But at least they were operational, unlike the missiles. All right, let's get to Zarqawi, shall we, ladies and gentlemen, because, man, has there been piffle on the air about this guy. First of all, this story from the memory hole was discussed on this broadcast way back when, and now would be a good time to revisit it. It's from NBC News. so you know it can be trusted. Abu Musab Zarqawi blamed for, this is a report from March 2, 2004. Zarqawi blamed for more than 700 killings in Iraq. NBC News has learned that long before the war, the Bush administration had several chances to wipe out his terrorist operation and perhaps even kill Zarqawi himself, but never pulled the trigger. In June 2002, U.S. officials say intelligence revealed that Zarqawi had set up a weapons lab in northern Iraq producing deadly ricin and cyanide. The Pentagon quickly drafted plans to attack the camp with cruise missiles and airstrikes. The White House debated it to death in the National Security Council. Says a military analyst with the Brookings Institution, here we had targets, we had opportunities, we had a country willing to support casualties, and we still didn't do it. 4 months later, intelligence showed Zarqawi was planning to use ricin in terrorist attacks in Europe. The Pentagon drew up a second strike plan. The White House again killed it. People were more obsessed with developing the coalition to overthrow Saddam than to execute the president's policy of preemption against terrorism, according to a former National Security Council member, Roger Cressy. In January 2003, police in London arrested six terrorist suspects and discovered a ricin lab connected to the camp in Iraq. The Pentagon drew up still another attack plan, and for the third time, the National Security Council killed it. Military officials said their case for attacking Zarqawi's operation was airtight, but the administration feared destroying the terrorist camp in Iraq could undercut its case for war against Saddam. The United States did finally attack the camp at the beginning of the war, but it was too late. Zarqawi and many of his followers were gone. March 2004, ladies and gentlemen. Deadline Baghdad, the Shiite leader of Iraq's largest political party, said Friday the death of Zarqawi won't end terrorism or tensions between Sunnis and Shiites. In a rare interview, Abdul Aziz al-Hakim, president of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, that sounds like a nice bunch of people, said that now Zarqawi is dead, the government's next priority must be to rid the country's security forces of Saddam loyalists. He didn't say how many of Saddam's followers he thought were in the government, but the comments by the country's top Shiite seem to augur more conflict with the Sunni minority. They claim they're unfairly labeled as members of Saddam's party. And according to Knight Ridder newspapers, a half dozen officials who have decades of experience tracking and analyzing Islamic militants offer a cautious view of the effect of Zarqawi's death. Quote, to me, it's not a severe blow, it's a dent, says Dennis Pluchinski, a former terrorism analyst in the State Department. It will probably have a minimal impact on the insurgency in Iraq and minimal impact on the global jihad movement, which is now self-sustaining. Michael Scheuer, the first chief of the CIA's Osama bin Laden tracking unit, called Zarqawi's death a tremendous success that will demoralize his organization and throw it into turmoil in the short term. But in the long run, he said, it's likely to have little impact on the bloodletting in Iraq. And as the dust settles, it may be a negative, because bin Laden may actually welcome Zarqawi's death. Zarqawi, who liked to call his own shots, never had more than an uneasy alliance of convenience with bin Laden's al-Qaeda network, the current and former official said, using the name of the organization as his brand. The Bush administration made him out to be more significant in life and in death than he was, said three current U.S. military and intelligence officials, speaking on condition of anonymity, because they aren't operational. It's a fair statement to say that Zarqawi's role has been overplayed somewhat, said retired CIA official Paul Pilar, former deputy director of the agency's counterterrorist center. Zarqawi and bin Laden, who came from vastly different backgrounds, disliked each other from their first meeting and sparred over tactics and strategy. Pilar and others said Zarqawi benefited from the al-Qaeda brand and set himself up as the self-styled leader of al-Qaeda in the land of the two rivers. But al-Qaeda leaders were alarmed by Zarqawi's rampage of beheadings. No beheadings, said the memos. One of the counterterrorism officials said Zarqawi's star appeared to have fallen in recent months, and intelligence reporting suggested that may have been in part because bin Laden and his aide were encouraging their allies in Iraq to abandon him this week. I guess it's fair to say, the ultimate abandonment. And I think that would be, ladies and gentlemen, if I'm not mistaken, and I don't think I am, time for news from outside the bubble. Oh, we've been waiting for this. Washington has stepped up pressure on Pakistan to allow its disgraced nuclear scientist, A.Q. Khan, to be questioned by United Nations inspectors after fresh traces of enriched uranium were found on equipment used at an Iranian military site. Dr. Khan, who's under house arrest. You comfy there, Doc? I know, we only have basic cable. I'm sorry, we don't have the premium tiers. Is believed to hold vital information about Iran's controversial atomic program, since he sold nuclear technology, plans, and technology to the Iranian regime. But General Perv Musharraf, Pakistan's president, is resisting pressure for access by the IAEA officials. It's believed this is because Dr. Khan, who's revered by Pakistanis as the father of the Islamic bomb, could reveal embarrassing details about the role of senior military and government figures in his supposedly renegade nuclear network. This is the Renegade Nuclear Network. The find of enrichment contamination on machinery has dealt a blow to Iran's claims that its sole nuclear goal is the generation of power rather than an atomic bomb. The facility where it was found was destroyed in 2004 on orders of the Iranian government before IAEA staff could inspect it. The IAEA believes that Dr. Khan could provide valuable information about the work taking place there. All 12 associates of Dr. Khan, arrested on suspicion of involvement in the nuclear proliferation racket, have now been released. And Pakistan has declared the case against Dr. Khan closed, despite few signs of any meaningful investigation. This is Pakistan, our friend. The British Nuclear Waste Cleanup Program, this is the cleanup of decommissioned nuclear power reactors, could cost more than $100 billion, according to the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority. The authority's previous estimate of the cost was only $70 billion. That's how much it's going to cost to clean up the cheap, safe nuclear plants. And an Australian report released this week by the Australian Nuclear Science and Technology Organization, found nuclear power would be competitive with gas or coal-fired electricity in Australia, but only if taxpayers helped to pay for it or shouldered the cost of producing it. That's cost-effective. That's competition. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Like the good Lord say, He promised to exalt us, but no is the way. How men be so greedy when there's so much left? All things are God given, and they all have been blessed. Let mourning, sobbing cease. Learn to help one another and live in perfect peace. If we just be humble, like the good Lord say, yeah. He promised to exalt us, but no.
you won't, others will. You don't understand me, but I'll love you still. That's the way God planned it. That's the way God wants it to be. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's the way,
yeah. God planned it. That's the way God wants it to be.
This is Le Show, and ladies and gentlemen, we're proposing to build a fence, a wall, what have you, on the wrong border. Dateline Toronto, two constables of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police plan to become the first male Mounties to marry each other later this month. If the public sees the RCMP, the Mounties, as representing the diversity of the community, says Jason Tree, one of the two, is marrying David Connors. That is good. Me, in response to the Senate vote this week, which refused to ban gay marriage, it's so simple, ladies and gentlemen. You don't ban gay marriage. That's utterly unfair and discriminatory. If you want to send a message, you ban gay divorce. Great. You want to be married? You're married. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the chairman, Republican chairman, if you will, see how smart it makes me sound just to say that? The Republican chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee kind of busted a gut this week, sent an angry letter to Vice President Dick Cheney. And here's, his name is Arlen Specter, chairman of the Judiciary Committee. Here's him, Senator Specter, explaining why he sent the letter.
I'm not accusing anybody of anything, and I'm not saying the vice president acted in bad faith. What I am saying is that you have a domestic surveillance program, wiretapping, which is in flat violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And if the president has inherent power under Article 2, he can trump that statute. But we have to know what the program is, and there has to be judicial review. And for weeks now, really months, I've been trying to get an answer from the administration on my legislation, which would take this program to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And the vice president did contact Republican members of the committee yesterday, didn't call me up, which was surprising, frankly.
And so Senator Specter, surprised, frankly, wrote the vice president a snarky letter. The vice president, just to clarify, this is the NSA spying program we're talking about. The vice president, a major defender of that program. The vice president went to Republican members of the Judiciary Committee to lean on them not to support any plans to either investigate or limit the scope of the NSA spying program, but didn't talk to the chairman of the committee, Specter. And Specter's complaint continued that that's even though they ran into each other, or Specter passed him a couple times in the brunch line at the weekly Senate Republican luncheon. Later in the week, the vice president sent a similarly snarky letter as a reply to Senator Specter. But one suspects that's what happened above ground. The real story may be elsewhere, next here on the show.
Next, intimate tales of America's first underground vice president. The action-packed diary of a man who's just a heartbeat away from history.
Dick Cheney,
Confidential. Say what you will about the Marines in Haditha, or the Army Corps of Engineers anywhere. The Navy Seabees in charge of the secure undisclosed. They're the best trained, best disciplined fighting force on the face of the planet. But just this week, they fixed a shower faucet leak, got rid of an infestation of fruit flies, and put in a 52-inch plasma screen in the secure undisclosed bedroom. All as a result of just one urgent message to the Pentagon. For the 30 or 31% of the public still able to feel proud about being an American, this week would have stoked that pride. Other brave men and women found, bombed, and eventually killed al-Zarqawi, which should be the definitive answer to the question, how come you guys can't find bin Laden? But even during a period where I had the good sense to give a commencement speech far enough south where I wouldn't get heckled, there are always some cockroaches in the caviar. This week it was a senator who goes by the name of Specter, although I like to think of him as a specter who goes by the name of senator. The fellow is just because he's the chairman of some so-called committee of Congress thinks he can push the big boys around. Well, this week, the big boys pushed back. For public consumption, I released a letter replying to his letter. But in the real world, you don't deliver your message by means of the U.S. mail. Thursday, 2:17 p.m.
I assure you, Senator Leahy, I will not back down this time. Oh, no, Senator, this time I really do mean it. I appreciate that, Senator. The thinking man's Orrin Hatch is exactly what I've tried to be. Thanks again for the call.
Always good to keep up relations across the aisle, just in case you need to move there, eh, Senator?
Mr. Vice President, I didn't see you come in.
Well, Arlen, excuse me if I read the rules wrong, but I always thought as the President of the Senate I was welcome in your office.
Coming through the front door, you would be.
Senator, to those of us who live in the secure, undisclosed world, the secret tunnel entrance to your office is the front door.
Well, that's a good point.
Sweet reason. I wish it was always enough. So, about your letter.
About yours. This is government at work?
Yes, sir. That doesn't mean it's pretty or nice. This is the sausage business at work isn't exactly an invitation to the Royal Freaking Ballet.
I'm aware of that, sir, but going behind the chairman's back on an issue of this importance sends a message of administration uncooperativeness and intransigence.
I'll tell you what message it sends, because I sent it. It sends a message that the 100 people in the Senate who get up every morning, look in the bathroom mirror and see a president aren't any match for the 2 people in the White House who get up every morning, look in the bathroom mirror and see a president.
The 2? Oh, right. Look, Mr. Vice President, I don't have any desire to engage in an extended battle with you.
I know that. It's what I'm counting on. You've got other fish to fry. You, on the other hand, Senator, are my fish.
Well, I guess I should be flattered.
You should be scared.
All right, then.
Mr. Senator, you know the only thing I like less than threatening people is spending a quiet evening at home with Lynn.
Yes, sir.
But the time comes when I even have to do that. So
you're going behind my back to try to get the majority members of my committee to dump me as chairman?
In all honesty, Senator, if I thought you caved that easily, I would have sent one of my aides through the tunnel. I could have stayed home and watched the censored Zarqawi video.
There's a...
Just footage of the time between the bombing of the safe house and his little thing.
I had no idea.
And you still don't. Now, I did bring along a little show-and-tell item. The audio CD of Ann Coulter's new book.
Godless, I heard about that. She goes after the 9/11 widows?
That's the current book. Mm. This is the next one. An attack on cancer survivors. It's called Hairless.
What the...
Here, a little sneak preview for you.
These chemo heads are getting an adrenaline rush out of their own IV tap. And while they bathe in the media spotlight as poor little baldies, they cram their agenda, whether it's putting an end to smokers' rights in any indoor environment or the clubbing to death of helpless asbestos companies, up the public's privates like a two-ton catheter. To anybody who doesn't need their red blood cells injected back into them, it's all as pathetic as post-prednisone skin tone.
And that's going to make my friends in the cancer survivor community boiling mad.
Yeah, that's what we thought. We, our office, kind of pitched the idea to Annie, gave her some seed money to get the first couple chapters written. Be a shame to see all those resources go to waste. Still
what?
Oh, I don't know, Senator. What is it you think you could do to please me right about now? Some judges approved? If I cared about the judicial branch, that might cut some eyes with me. Strengthen the Patriot Act still further? Nice, if I cared about legislation. No, sir. I think about the only thing you could do is back way off this crackpot idea of investigating the terrorist surveillance program. We'll write you a nice little piece of fig leaf legislation if that floats your boat. Miss Calder will be glad to go after sex slaves in Darfur or somebody else.
You know, it's not any sensitivity I have. My hair has grown back very well.
It has indeed, and I'm sure Annie would be glad to share any hair care tips he might.
But for the other folks in the survivor community, this would be such a vicious blow.
Oh, I know, Senator. If my thing was cancer instead of heart trouble, I'd actually know how you feel. Instead, I'll just have to say it and let it go at that.
I appreciate that much. All right, Mr. Vice President, I have just one request.
Yes, Mr. Senator.
On that fig leaf legislation you're going to write, make the fig leaf big enough that there's no hair showing.
You got it. Turning a little weasel like Arlen Specter doesn't just make me proud to be an American. It makes me proud to be me. End of partial diary for early June 2006. Sincerely yours, Dick Cheney. Confidential.
I know how to do. One is to dream, two is loving.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got to stop paying attention to the media and start paying attention to our own government officials who can tell us the good news about Iraq. Here, for example, is U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad in a confidential cable to the State Department back in Washington from about a month ago, made public this week in the Washington Post, to virtually no notice by anybody else in the media. The good news from our own ambassador, reporting back to the State Department, quote, crime in Iraq is rated as critical and will continue to get worse for the foreseeable future. Crime, terrorism, and warfare are a significant threat in all parts of Iraq. The U.S. Department of State continues to strongly warn U.S. citizens against travel to Iraq, which remains very dangerous. Remnants of the former regime, transnational terrorists, criminal elements, and numerous insurgent groups remain active. Attacks against military and civilian targets continue throughout the country, including inside the Green Zone. Planned and random killings are common, as are kidnappings for ransom and political reasons. Overall security in Iraq is worsening, continues the U.S. ambassador, reporting confidentially to the State Department in Washington. With kidnapping by criminal gangs and insurgents a particular problem, these bold, well-equipped, and sophisticated groups, gangs, are terrorizing businessmen and contractors, in addition to the easy-to-nab odd journalists. Foreigners of all walks of life have been kidnapped and murdered. No one is immune. Outspoken critics of the war who painted themselves as allies of the insurgency have been kidnapped, mistakenly believing that by aligning themselves with the hostage-takers, they could guarantee themselves an exemption from being targeted. A stable government may be the first step in a reduction in political violence, but for now, armed militia loyal to various non-governmental entities have limited to extensive control of parts of Baghdad and some cities in Iraq. The local police are poorly trained, poorly equipped, and corrupt. Americans have in the past called for and received assistance in emergencies from the U.S. military, but the response time has been measured in hours, not minutes. The good news from Iraq, thanks to our own ambassador, ladies and gentlemen, is I don't believe the media. Believe our guy. Deadline Washington, Iraq funding, congressional Republicans killed a provision in an Iraq funding war bill that would have put the United States on record against permanent U.S. bases in that country, congressional aide said on Friday. As originally passed by the House, the Pentagon would have been prohibited from spending any of its funds for entering into a military basing agreement with Iraq, a similar amendment passed by the Senate. The Bush administration said it does not want to place any artificial timelines on a U.S. presence in Iraq, but it has not ruled out permanent bases in Iraq, and now the Congress has taken off any prohibition of such. And news of the new Iraq from the Telegraph newspaper in Britain. It promises the typical fare of any woman's glossy magazine, but the pronouncements of al-Sadaka, Sadaka's back, have the kind of clout that Western fashion columnists can only dream of. It's the new monthly must-read for female followers of Iraq's Orthodox Shia Muslim faith. The name translates as the virtuous woman. Its vision of aspirational womanhood is at odds with the secular one promoted by Iraq's Western liberators. Instead of talking about equality or the right to work, it sees the ideal woman as a dutiful wife and mother whose only dress is the hijab, the black cloak that leaves only the eyes uncovered. Get a hijab! While the growth of free media has been touted as one of the few successes of Iraq's fragile democracy, magazines such as al-Sadaka spread an outlook more in tune with the orthodox elements in the country's new Shia-dominated government, whom many non-Shia Iraqis accuse of trying to turn Iraq into an Iranian-style Theocracy. Sadaka's sexual advice pages. Questions relating to bedroom etiquette are dealt with by a theologian from Najaf's Kufa University Law School, who relies mainly on advice from centuries-old Shia edicts. No man should ever look directly at his wife's private parts, she counsels, or his son will be born blind. Nor should he read the Quran during sexual congress, as this would most likely see both man and woman smitten in their beds by hellfire. The new Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. You bought it, you own it. And my favorite news story of the week, finally. The Rupert Murdochs are busy renovating their new apartment, Fifth Avenue townhouse, which they bought for $44 million. According to Forbes magazine, Rupert and his wife were living in the posh Pierre Hotel waiting for the renovations to be completed. When that lease ended, the two temporarily relocated to a nearby penthouse. During that time, Rupert's wife was quoted by The New Yorker as saying, "We are homeless. We're staying in hotels, whichever one gives us the cheapest rate." The penthouse they were moving into came without furnishing, so the Murdochs, according to a real estate source quoted in Forbes, have been asking to borrow couches and beds from model apartments in the building. I got some furniture you can borrow, Roop. Call me. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world via the American Forces Network for a little while. Up and down the east coast of North America via the planet WBCQ. Channel 136 on Sirius Satellite Radio. The mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it. HarryShear.com and KCRW.com. Available as a free download at audible.com/theshow and is available as a free podcast at KCRW.com. And it would be just like you letting Rupert borrow one of your couches if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack at Tip of the Le Show Chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, and Chicago desks. Le Show playlists available at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.